Woo!
Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy with you today.
Happy Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
And I'm feeling like celebrating over here on this Tuesday.
Why are you feeling like celebrating?
Because we've hit 200 episodes.
200 episodes. High five.
Big day. Yeah. Very exciting. Actually, it would be funny if we were like, psych, we can't do math. We're actually beyond 200, which I think we might be.
We did some bonus episodes. This is the 200th weekly episode, though.
Oh,
as long
fair.
As we numbered them all. I think that's what it adds up to. It's possible that maybe we're at 202, but still, a celebration's a celebration. We're sticking with it.
We're sticking with it, even if there's poor math. Every time I try to do math on live air, I'm like, Megan, stop. Do not go there. Put up boundaries. Put up boundaries and we're on math. But I think we did it. And
math,
I'm excited.
Math is impossible. Like, I was so good at it when I was young. And now I'm desperately fearing Leo being in school because I hear that their math is just impossible now. I'm not going to be able to compute. I don't think I'm cut out for it.
Well, maybe it's actually better for us. It's like theoretical math.
Okay.
Maybe we just need to work in like letters instead of numbers and see what happens.
Well, you know where my math is really good? In geometry, because at the race last weekend in the 50K, a lot of it was on like kind of roads and jeep roads and things. So you had a lot of opportunities to do tangents. And every single time I was cutting the perfect tangent, it was wild. I was thinking back, I was like, damn, I'm going to get a 5 on the AP test for tangents in this race.
I actually think a lot about tangents too when I'm racing. And yeah. I'm like, this is so nerdy and weird. I think the difference between the two of us is you think about it when you're training and when you're racing.
Yes.
Because there have been so many times we've been running together. Like this weekend,
we ran
together on Magnolia Road. And I'm like, David is going to take a tangent straight into a semi truck.
Well, the pickup trucks are going like 70 miles an hour on that dirt road.
It's true. Actually, this weekend, there was a pickup truck that flew by me at like 95 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And we were running separately. And I actually gave the pickup truck, I never, ever do this. Behind the eyes that like passed me, yeah. I gave it the middle finger.
What?
Because I was like.
In the air?
I know. Because I was like, it's coming after David. Like we were running separately.
Oh my God.
Isn't that the worst feeling when you're running apart from someone and there's like this pickup truck on a mission to go truck someone?
Yeah. I literally go truck them. I love your way of thinking there. So what you're thinking is I want to anger this pickup truck driver even more so that as he goes to David, he's going 20 miles an hour faster.
As David is coming on the tangent right into the nose of the 90 mile hour power pickup truck.
My epitaph is going to say, but he was good at geometry.
Actually, your epitaph is going to say he was trucked, but he was risen. It's Easter weekend after
all. It was. I did run on Magnolia on Easter. I was thinking about that while I was out on the Magnolia a little bit in that every time on Easter or any holiday like that, I always want to have a funny Strava title, but I got to be careful not to be sacrilegious, right? Because I want to uplift everybody's belief systems. And so I really wanted to say, you know, Magnolia is a rolling road. It goes up and down and up and down. And it's famous for that. It's notoriously where a lot of the scenes in Running with the Buffaloes, a great book that you all should read about the Colorado team in 1999, a lot of those scenes happen there. And it's because it's such hard hills above 8,000 feet. And I wanted my Strava title to be, he is risen and he is fallen and he is risen and he is fallen to mirror the hills, but I wasn't able to do it.
It's the perfect training stimulus when you can meet your ancestors and then get resurrected again, much like we've been building off this from Mike Smith. But I actually had that same thought out there about like he is risen and he is fallen.
Yeah.
And it's funny how we were coming to parallel Strava titles on totally separate runs. But do you know what my other thought was?
What?
I'm kind of disappointed in Canyon's 100K because you just fall. You don't rise again.
Oh, because Canyon 100K is net downhill.
And I'm like, we need all courses to end with being risen. Yeah.
So yeah, Canyon's 100K kind of ends on Good Friday. And you want it to end on the resurrection day.
I want to get resurrected. Yeah. Maybe I'll feel differently about it once I get to the bottom of the hill. I'm like, you know what?
Yeah.
I don't believe in resurrection anymore.
We should be really careful with jokes like that, Megan, after your heart thing.
I know.
No more resurrection jokes for you. You are limited in what you can do with that. Okay, so we have such a fun 200th episode. We're going to do some reflections in a few minutes. Before we do that, though, thank you all for making this possible. Like, we never thought we'd get to episode 200. We'll get into some of our thoughts on that in just a few minutes.
It's truly a reflection of like the community that we've gotten to build in this process. And it's you and I sitting here on a date.
Yeah.
But I just feel like we've gotten to share that with so many people. And when we go to races, like we did at Crown King Scramble last weekend and some of these other races, it's like, I just feel like we get to see the amazing community out there and it makes me so happy.
Especially now that the hats are out in the world and the shirts and things. So always remember, yell huzzah at strangers and occasionally you'll find another podcast listener and it can lead to great friendships.
You know, maybe I should have yelled huzzah at the pickup truck.
Yeah.
What do you think would have been? That's kind of passive aggressive. Where is the middle finger? I have literally never given anyone the finger in my life.
Yeah. So you did it in the air. Like you actually, a middle finger it was in the like, sky.
But it was interesting. No, I don't think there was like no chance the truck saw it, which is why I did it. It was for me.
It was a middle finger for you.
It was a middle finger for me. And I was like, I need to manifest this.
Okay. Well, if you had yelled huzzah at the pickup truck, maybe they would have been really into it. Maybe it would have been like, I don't know, one of those, I don't know, Tyler Childers pickup trucks rather than the really intense ones. Okay, so a great episode for you. We're going to be talking about some post-race recovery thoughts. The best story ever from World Cross Country. Stick around for that. Some episode 200 reflections. 5 ways our training and coaching approach has changed since we started this podcast, highlighting some of the top end takeaways that you all can have. A mini science corner on steep climbing. That's cool. News and fun things, including the return of Adam Peter God. He has been resurrected. A new caffeine study. Important cautionary science on Benadryl. Stick around for that if you ever take that medication. And then a question on leaving your job. And finally, hot takes.
Well, as we were preparing for this episode this week, there was a little bit of like pressure in my brain thinking about like the 200th episode. And we announced baby Leo coming into the world on episode 100. We announced my pregnancy. And I was like, what are we going to do for episode 200? And then I had a fuck it moment. And I was like, let's just do our usual thing. And I feel like it's how we often celebrate anniversaries around here. We're like, we're just going to have a really good day, a really fun day. And I feel like we're bringing that in news and fun things, because there are some banging news and fun things ahead. And it's the perfect way to celebrate 200.
Wow. I actually have a big announcement for you, Megan.
What?
I'm pregnant. I couldn't let you be the only one.
Actually, that would be amazing. I'd be so pumped on that.
Men's rights.
Actually, I could see though, as soon as your heart rate starts rising in workouts in the first trimester, you'd be like, no.
I couldn't handle it. That's for sure. Okay. Quick reflections really quickly on post-race. So I think we both had interesting experiences after this event in the sense that we monitor a lot of different variables very closely. And, you know, this was a 50K that was net uphill. It was difficult, but not that hard in the big scheme of things. And as always with this, I assume my body is going to bounce back pretty well because I do a lot of good long runs. I do a lot of good training and it didn't. It took a while. And I think it's one of those good step back points to remind yourself what actually happens to your body in these events and why it's important to take a step back, even if you don't necessarily feel like it. Because like for us, we're able to look under the hood with different numbers that we're tracking.
Yeah, I had a very similar experience post-race where my body was taking a long ass time to recover. And I almost had the same reflection of like, what the heck, Megan? And then I had the realization that we talked about last week that I think for me, my racing was exponentially better than anything I've done in training recently. Yeah. And that's often how I am as an athlete. Like I tend to race above my training fitness levels. But I think when you do that, my body just hasn't seen that type of performance in a very long time.
Yeah.
And so I got fully trucked by it. And I was pretty surprised. And like come Thursday, Friday, I started to panic. And then I had to remind myself, I was like, Megan, this is kind of how you classically recover from a 50K.
I think as athletes get more fit relative to their background, those issues become much more salient. Because a good example, I always say this to athletes, that it's different when you're using a bazooka versus a slingshot, right? Like once you have a bazooka, you can do a lot of damage without really realizing it. So for us, we were tracking things like HRV. My HRV tanked overnight after the first few days. It interestingly had a little bump at first. Similar with resting heart rate, it went a little bit higher than normal. And my heart rate response during runs was a good 8 to 10 beats per minute higher than it should have been at these same exact outputs that I have really good data on.
Meanwhile, mine was 20 to 25 beats per minute higher at the same output.
Which is scary, given your background. Which is scary.
I know, given my heart issues, it actually made me panic. I took a rest day on Friday because I was like, Megan, heart is not a hamstring. Do not mess with a heart that is that high. But I do think in reality, like I felt fine this weekend, which was such a welcome relief that I do think it was just like the trauma of the race period. And what I tell athletes too is like when you have a strong performance, the body feels it. And sometimes it's like nonlinear. Too. I felt pretty good on Monday, Tuesday. Then all of a sudden, Wednesday, Thursday, I was like, what is happening? It's like an apocalyptic physiological response.
And we see that a lot. I mean, by the time we got to Saturday, we went on the superest of super shuffles. I'm making up words. Such a shuffle. And it got to the point that at the end of the run, I had Megan staring at her heart rate during the run because I was just like really wanting to be cautious with her heart. And when the heart rate got just a little bit higher, I started yelling at her, maybe in a way that was not very good.
I was like, hey, that's like the perfect way to raise a heart rate. Actually, I was like, David, we need to stop and recollect ourselves and move on and shuffle. But it was actually a wonderful reflection on shuffling too, is I had the reminder that it was so pleasant and enjoyable to go out there and shuffle in the mountains and have that date time together. And it was the reflection that I don't think I do that enough in training. And it was just wonderful. Like, we had that date on Saturday. I came back and listened to a fiction audiobook on Sunday. Yeah. And it was just really, really fun and easy to get out the door. And it was my personal reminder. I was like, girl, you need to shuffle a little more often.
And I think that brings us to a question that goes directly into it. So here it is. Hi, David and Megan. Congrats on your awesome race performances last weekend. Just wondering, what are your post-race routines? Besides eating lots of awesome food, do you make sure to do anything else post-race and in the following week, i.e. compression socks or anything like that? Does this differ from normal long run slash workout recovery in any way? Thanks.
This is a great question.
So good. And I think it's really important because as we enter race season, racing, I think, is the best training, but it's only the best training if you then have the recovery periods. Like, overtraining does not come from training. I think people—
From racing, you mean?
Well, no, I mean, yes, from racing. Good point.
Yeah. I was like, actually, because my point was going to be, I was like, wait a second, are opposition? Yeah. Is I feel like so often athletes have the assumption that races are going to make them overtrain.
Yeah.
And if you take proper recovery and like back off from races, as well as like tapering into them, I feel like it's truly the training itself that is the vehicle for overtraining.
You just saved me there, Megan. You almost—
It's literally in the name. It's not over racing. It's overtraining.
Killed by a pickup truck. But you just redeemed yourself. So, you know, you have resurrected my love for you very much. Yeah, exactly. So I always think it's stacking stresses. So where acute stresses become chronic stress is one after the other after the other. And I see this all the time after races. Like, even some of the people that were competing in the 50K hopped back into training so quickly. And I'm like, go harder in the race if you're able to do that. And I think that this is a wonderful opportunity to develop. So the first point is what Megan was getting to right before we got to the question, which is easy aerobic volume is your friend. And it can be really easy. And that goes for training generally. And I think it's something that maybe you've come around to more as you progress, is that easy can be so easy. Because like, Z1 type stuff in a 5-zone model is not stressful on the body. Like, it just isn't. You can do a pretty damn high amount of it, even if you're injury prone, and be pretty safe.
And it's kind of wonderful how the body feels after that. So I did an 18 miler this weekend, which is pretty long after a 50K.
And on Magnolia Road, so hard.
I classically wouldn't do that, though I'm training for Canyon's 100K. So it's, and I was a little behind. So I was kind of like, okay, we need to kind of stack these stresses.
Classic cramming for 100K.
Yeah, I know. It's, you know what? I do best cramming for tests.
Okay.
Cramming for races and then like having a big taper. But I felt like amazing after the long run. Like, my legs didn't hurt. And it is truly the power of the shuffle. But I think in addition to kind of the aerobic volume that we're thinking of on the race, or backing off aerobic volume, but keeping things like very shuffly, I do like to work in strides, because I feel like the neuromuscular activation and output of that almost aids in recovery.
Definitely.
And I think this is even more important for athletes like doing multi-day races or 100 mile races, is the nervous system just kind of goes into a frenzy.
Yeah.
And like realigning that a little bit with like this neuromuscular turnover of strides helps a ton.
Yeah. So I think the two big buckets here are the nervous system on one end, which kind of starts to shut down after races, and the endocrine system on the other, which needs recovery time. And that's where like very easy and strides or cross training can be so, so helpful. And then another thing that I think people sometimes overlook, and we do too, we had a come to Jesus moment, very appropriate for Easter weekend, is on hydration, because your body does have a lot of waste products it needs to clear. And I always try to think, all right, I want to give myself oral IVs, right? So IVs are not allowed, but you know what is allowed? Drinking good amounts of fluid with electrolytes. And sometimes I just let it fall by the wayside.
I know, but it's so fun. Actually, this weekend, do what I realized.
What?
I will drink so much more fluid if I'm just walking around with a hydro flask all day. Like, there's something about the ease of flow of fluid out of a hydro flask. I'm just like typing on my computer, smashing a hydro flask. And I'm going to be that weird person now that's hydro flasking on a Zoom call.
Well, why don't you wear like a camelback or something all day?
Okay, that is actually, that's a great idea.
Isn't it a great idea?
Yeah, I actually really like that.
What they should have is business camelbacks.
Right?
So you only see the camelbacks that look kind of ridiculous and make you look like kind of a loser. What we should see is incorporate it into like our suits or our fashion wear. I want to go to the club with a camelback. I want to twerk and not cramp.
Just put apple juice in there and be like, it's not beer. I promise.
I'm actually kind of into this idea.
I know. It's kind of genius. Actually, it's, I feel like a lot more runners are straying away from the hydration, like the hydration bladders in the back, and going more towards the bottles in the front.
You never see bladders in the back anymore, really.
It's interesting. But why do you think that is? Like, do you think it's easier to access? I mean, it's easier to access the two on the front. And I think it's better in terms of like how the body is weighted biomechanically.
So I think front weight is good, but I also just think it's impossible not to have the camelback on the back bounce around a lot. Like you just can't have it tight enough without totally restricting your breathing. So, you know, I think that's the main reason, but there's an opportunity there.
There is an opportunity. But I think in addition to hydration, fueling too. So we've been like post-race, even though you're resting and recovering, it's a time to really bump up the fueling.
And especially metabolic rate goes sky high, even when you're recovering. I mean, for both of us, we were waking up hungry despite doing big ass burgers and things like that. Like we did such good burgers that I did an Instagram post on Big's American Sports Grill in Peoria, Arizona, where it just mentioned that we got a burger there. Didn't tag them or anything. Big's commented and said, next burger's on us. So someone alerted them. And this was the best moment of my life. And I'm taking that sponsorship. But even with that insane burger that was literally probably like 3/4 of a pound, we were hungry. So it's just a reminder to keep that coming.
You know how we do shoe reviews? We need to get in the business of doing food reviews. Wouldn't that be really fun? Kind of like the Food Network, like going around doing post-ultra food reviews.
Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives swap edition?
Yeah, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Ultras swap edition. Yes, that would be so fun.
That would be such a good idea. We should incorporate that.
Yeah. Okay, do you know what my terrible hot take is, though, that you're going to vastly disagree with?
What?
I actually crave more vegetables post-race. I think it's because I consume like so many like hydrogels and gels and like things like that during the race that for whatever reason, my body wants to consume. I mean, I have very high caloric, like much higher caloric intake post-race just to optimize recovery, but I do have higher vegetable intake too. And I don't know where that comes from.
So you're craving like what type of vegetable? Like how does this work?
Like broccoli.
You're craving broccoli. Okay. Well, name another vegetable.
You're like, tell me what vegetables
I'm like taking notes.
I've had kale. I've had Brussels sprouts. But it reminds me because I think about like Leo's fruit and vegetable intake.
Yeah.
And the other day I asked you, I was like, okay, like what vegetables has Leo had today? And you named macaroni and cheese.
It was made out of garbanzo beans.
I know, which is fair. They're a legume, right?
Megan, it counts.
I just thought it was hilarious that I'm like thinking about fruits and vegetables and you're like macaroni and cheese.
Okay. Here's my unified theory. Vegetables are on a spectrum, right? Like broccoli absorbs a little bit, things like that. Kale does not absorb it. Like there is no way you can tell me, unless my GI system is just fundamentally different than everyone else's, which is possible, that kale does anything nutritionally because I don't absorb it. It just comes out.
Okay, that is fair. I do think you have to acknowledge the confounding variable that your GI system is a shit show.
Yeah.
I was actually going to have a comment about like cleaning toilets in the household that like it should not just fall on me.
No, we don't have to clean them anymore, Megan. We bought a toilet that is the top of the line. You flush it.
It still doesn't work.
You flush it and it sounds like seismometers go off in Japan. Right? It's like there's geologists that are like, what happened in Boulder, Colorado?
Okay. But I do think we need to try. You can consume kale and cardboard. And see what happens.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, from a GI system perspective and from an energy system perspective.
So as we're thinking about some of these elements, particularly the hydration element, this is a place to go to the feed. One of the things we love is always having electrolytes in the large quantities of fluid. Because if you're just drinking water for this amount, some really good studies show that it can quite be negative for your hydration rather than positive. And during training, this is so important. What we did in the races is we used precision hydration tabs, and we would have them in a little baggie, and then we would put them in our bottles as we approached aid stations. It was such a great way to get the necessary electrolytes, and you can get all of these at the feed. So go to thefeed.com/swap, S-W-A-P. There you get an $80 free credit. So there's no downside to just going there, click and claim reward, using it whenever you have time.
Also, swap water bottles there as well.
Oh yeah, you get water bottles that are branded with the T-Rex.
And bright yellow, which is my favorite color. So it's really cool to have that. But actually, we've done a lot in terms of, we've like talked a lot about gels and our favorite types of gels, namely like Precision and Beta Fuel. And I talked about goo roctanes that are hard to slurp, but make me feel like I'm like launching into another planet. What is your favorite type of like drink mix?
Oh,
we haven't really talked about this.
I love the Precision Tats. Even though they're low calorie, they're so easy and portable that for me, like I can always take them in. And they always make me feel great. Like as we talked about the GI issues, I've never had GI issues on them to the point that I now always have one before I exercise as well, because I've started to associate it with good GI issues.
Actually, you literally have them all day long. Anyone who walks into our house, like just guests that aren't even athletes, you're like, would you like a Precision Tab? You do it all the time. It's like your version of offering people wine.
You're even like, people that are like never going to, like they just don't do athletic things. Even though everyone's an athlete, they don't exercise like in a structured way. I'm like, here, take Precision.
And you serve it to them in a wine glass. It's pretty funny.
It's my love language.
But I actually like mixing those tabs with like drink mixes that actually have calories. So I love combining goo roctane drink mix, which is delicious, and then tossing in a Precision Tab because I'm a slightly higher like sodium sweater. So I toss in a 500 into the goo roctane drink mix and it's delicious.
Yeah. So experiment with those. We absolutely love those tabs, and go to thefeed.com/swap for your free $80. All right. on to one of the best topics ever, and this is going to be a transition into episode 200, is world cross country, and specifically Ali Ostrander's journey. So we've talked about her a good bit on the podcast, and the reason is that, one, you know, we coach her, but two, she's a really close friend who shares her journey publicly. And so there's all of this, you know, she's sharing as she goes through it in her YouTube channel. So subscribe to that. And we got to watch before the race, her 3-year documentary. She did a 13-minute 3-year documentary. And at the end, I don't know about you, Megan, but I was bawling my eyes out with like happy tears.
We were crying. It was so wild. But also I started crying too, because somewhere around like 8 minutes in, she talked about the fact of how she's made a coaching transition.
Yeah.
And she talked about working with you. And then she started flashing up like 13 different text messages that you've just random text messages that you've sent her, like, you're a beast. You're crushing it. Yeah. And it's, I just thought like the level of belief that you've had in her, and I have in her too. She's one of the most talented athletes in the world. And we see that again and again. And I just thought it was so cool to see it like manifested in text messages. And I'm just one proud of you, David, for the amount of like just love and kindness and belief that you've poured into Ali, but also for Ali too, because I feel like sometimes as an athlete, it's almost hard to accept that belief and hard to accept that love, especially if you've like grown up in other coaching systems. And Ali is just such an inspiration.
I'm glad she didn't flash all my texts. It's like, kale is just pre-poop.
did you send that to her?
I think I have it one
cardboard
point.
Is pre-poop.
I'm joking when I say that I love vegetables. Just not the more fibrous ones. Like the broccoli is great.
No. Legumes, which you think are vegetables. Yeah.
Macaroni and cheese is my favorite vegetable. I quite like it. What you said in my role in that little video, which is just a snippet. It's like 10 seconds. I am not a significant role in her journey in the big scheme of things. Like Ali is on her own journey, of which I am a tailwind.
But that's often how coaching is like, if we have a life or training montage of like to be 10 seconds included in that is really cool, but hopefully it's like a 10 second tailwind. And I feel like for me as a coach, it's a very empowering thing.
But what it reminds me of is I was listening to a great podcast by Scott Galloway. It was the Prof G podcast last week on the episode that he interviewed Jonathan Haidt, who we talked about on last week's episode. And he did a monologue at the start where one of the things that he described learning as he ages is that essentially our role, whether it's as mentors or parents or any of these other things, is to give evidence to the achievements of others. Mm. And I thought it was a wonderful way to encapsulate like what I think good coaching can be outside of the numbers, is that often we go through life and we don't have this like understanding of our own achievements and capabilities. And I think a good coach is there to say, hey, look at this. You are fucking amazing.
It's to show athletes a glitzed up mirror and be like, not even glitzed up, but this is like the reality of who you are, and reflect it back on them.
Well, I think we often have funhouse mirrors that are telling us all these shitty things about ourselves, right?
A funhouse mirror, you look into it and you see a clown back and you're like, fuck me.
Yeah. Like one of those scary clowns. Like
I know. That's
in the
ones that would literally fuck you.
Like a sewer clown. Oh no.
Oh man.
Episode 200 sewer clowns.
We are coming full circle.
That's an Easter egg for people that remember what that's all about. So I wanted to read a quote from the end of her video, and make sure you go watch it because I think it's really, really great.
Also, I love that you have this quote. So did you like watch the video and then transcribe it at the same time?
Yes.
That's hustle. And I also respect it too, because it's like the type of hustle that would give me a ton of inspiration, because these quotes are so good.
Well, do you remember how many times I've watched it? Like, I probably have watched it 6 times.
So yesterday we were up in the mountains with your family and you just told your aunt, you're like, do you want to watch this really inspiring YouTube video? Your aunt has no knowledge of running. So you gathered our whole family around and had them watch the Ali Ostrander video, which was so cool.
It's so good. Okay. So here's the quote. I used to stand on the start line ashamed because I knew that no matter how well I did, the way I had gotten there was not right. So for context, she was treated for an eating disorder at the start of this video, like 3 years before. I had manipulated my body and jeopardized my health in an effort to maximize my performance. I never would have told anyone to do the same thing. And yet I stood on the line in a body that was the result of my disordered behaviors. When I stood on that start line in January, this was at the US Cross Country Championships, I was nervous. I was afraid. I was unsure, but I was not ashamed. I felt pride in the work that I had put in, with the knowledge that I had done it the right way. I felt gratitude for everyone that was there, who supported me for every single training montage. I felt brave for stepping to the line amidst self-doubt. And more than anything, I felt inspired to prove to everyone, and especially to myself, that the best version of myself was the one that was on the line that day.
Okay, that is so incredible. And so she goes on to say this, and then the last thing on the screen is the fact that World Championships is in 3 days.
And she just made Team USA in January. And so the Worlds was this weekend.
So what a badass thing to post this ahead of World Championships in 3 days. And as I was like watching this and especially hearing that quote, I think what came back to me is that I hoped, and I think this is how Allie felt based off of these words, that she's standing on the start line at World Cross Country Championships, knowing that by standing there and her journey that she's already won. Yeah. Like she's already won the race of life itself and the race of like high performance and being a fully lived athlete. And I just like, that's when I started crying. I lost it. I was like, this is so cool.
Well, to share what she texted to me, like to flip the script there. On the morning of the race, you know, I texted her normal stuff pre-race, and all she wrote back was commit and believe. Mm. And then she went out and did it and had an amazing day. She was second American at World Cross Country, 30th place, which at World Cross Country is insane.
Actually,
it's so good.
Yeah, for context, actually, there's been like a 13-year drought of not having a top 10 women's finisher at World Cross Country Championships for the US. And then for men, a 7-year drought of not having a top 20 finisher.
Yeah.
So to put that performance into context, outstanding performance.
And so much of it came back to her mental approach that she's developed from these years of adversity, right? Like she had to go through the lowest lows that she describes in this documentary to reach the point that this World Cross Country course, which was going to be hot, unseasonably so, in the mid 80s, which this time of year is really hard, and she hadn't done that much heat training. It was also kind of a hilarious course. They had hay bales. They had made up hills. I don't understand why they didn't just make it a trail race instead of having a flat course with funny things on it.
Yeah, I was really, it actually reminded me a lot of like a mouse going through a maze.
Yeah.
Like, you know how they do like research trials with mice and they got to like go over these obstacles and like through the wheel and the hay bales and like the orientation, they were kind of diagonally oriented. I'm like, why would they do that?
You would win a world championship if there were cheese at the end.
Oh, for sure. The amount of cheese I can consume is kind of wild.
Yes. Or this week, broccoli.
Yeah. Well, actually, the two go hand in hand.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
I have broccoli with my cheese. The broccoli just kind of like justifies the cheese.
Yeah, yeah. You have your cheese with a side of broccoli. In fact, that is one of my ultimate cooking specialties is Megan's like, David, can we have the cheesy broccoli? Yeah. So I take a thing of frozen broccoli. This is vegetables can be acceptable in my world. Think of frozen broccoli. I put it in. I put some salt on. I put some pepper on, just a little bit. And a lot of olive oil on the bottom. And then after it gets nice and warm, I take two handfuls of cheese and just dump it all on. So literally everything is inundated with cheese.
Actually, my favorite meal is just fried cheese. It's the aftermath of the broccoli and cheese. Like when the cheese drippings come down and they don't fix to anything, just going in with a spoon and eating the fried cheese. So good.
Yeah. Every single time I use like a casserole dish or whatever, I leave empty space and then just put cheese in the empty space because I'm like, that's for Megan.
Well, actually what you do is for leftovers, every night there's like new empty space.
Yeah.
So you add cheese. So it's like the cheese just keeps continuing on down.
It's like the game Risk where they have like the little armies extending their reign. The cheddar is just taking over the world slowly.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Yeah.
It's like not climate change, but cheddar cheese that's coming for us all.
Yeah, it actually makes me feel much better about the future. I'm going to start thinking of it that way. So with that really tough course, not only did she persevere, she absolutely rocked it. She moved up in the standings, just, you know, and ran so fast. And so I don't know. To me, this journey is one of those moments of reflection that her videos started right around when the podcast started, you know, in 2020, and the documentary that she described, and thinking about all she's done in that short period of time and how she's rethought herself and how she got to this start line and is such a champion now, independent of her race results. She's a champion human on the inside and out. It made me think about like, so cool what can happen in a relatively short time.
And I think the cool part too is she's a champion human. And I think at the same time too, she's having champion level performances as well. So I think sometimes when we talk about these topics, athletes are like, but what about my performance? Like, what if I go through this journey and it's harder for my performance? And
yeah, whether that's eating disorder or mental health or all these things, it's like
whatever the journey is.
People think the advantage sometimes is the negative things you do to yourself that actually have nothing to do with your success. They just like coincide with it. It's correlation, not causation.
It's like being an artist, and there's like the theory that like, you know, depression or anxiety helps artists produce. And it's like, maybe it's a factor in who they are, but they'd probably be great artists if they worked through that with like therapy or medications or things like that.
Yeah.
But I think my point is that like oftentimes when you start these journeys, it is a little bit hard. Like the body is changing. Hormones are changing. I call it puberty 2.0.
Yeah.
Like sometimes the body has to like feel new levels of like estrogen or like, you know, go through these bodily changes. But I do think in the end, it is also for performance in addition to a fully lived life. And there's never pressure to feel the combination of both of those. But I always think for athletes starting out on the journey is that it can be both.
Yeah. Your best performance comes from your healthiest, strongest self. both inside and out.
Yes.
And, we're so inspired by Allie in that. And that's a transition to our episode 200 mini reflection. And how much things have changed for us in different ways, often through the podcast. Like, this has been an avenue for us to grow. So thank you all. How cool is this, Megan?
Well, it's also so fun to talk about it on the heels of Allie Ostrander. I feel like she's like handing us the baton and we're the anchor and we're like, we just got to do great things off of what she just did.
That'd be so much pressure.
It's so much pressure.
You'd do so well as an anchor leg. I don't know if I would.
I was always the anchor leg. We had like kindergarten relays on up to like high school and I was always anchor leg and it was always so much pressure.
And you probably crushed it though.
Yeah. I had to learn to deal with the pressure. Did you ever anchor a relay?
No.
No?
No, I mean, I didn't really do much of that and I wasn't...
You're like, anchoring a relay with scoring touchdowns.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Totally. So let's go through a few things that have changed for us. When we first started this podcast, we were just talking into the mic for 30 minutes. Actually, we didn't even have a mic. We were just talking into the computer.
Were we really talking into the computer?
Uh-huh.
That is wild.
The sound quality must be horrid. And we didn't have any editing
system. Why did we not have a mic? They're like $100 for a good mic.
I mean, because we started it on a whim.
That's true. Yeah.
It was
like, one day we were like, let's do a podcast.
Yeah. It was never meant to be anything. And I think there's a good takeaway there. It's like, if you have any ideas, just put it into the world and you will figure it out as you go, rather than having to have a fully finished product at the start. I think often people do that and it's like, wait, just do the thing and then go from there. So it's really insane to think about, you know, 4 years ago, almost lining up with you and just talking.
It's really wild. It's also weird to think about. Like, I feel like it's much like a race. Like, we have landmarks along the way.
Yeah.
And episode 100, we announced that Leo would be coming into the world. I think I was like 13 weeks pregnant when we announced this. And now we're on episode 200. And it's also kind of wild to think about how our lives have changed since episode 100 and just like everything that's gone into that.
Yeah. And I mean, Leo, we don't talk about him that much on here, but he's obviously the biggest part of our life right now. He just turned 17 months. He's running around. He really loves going up and down hills. He does hill repeats. Classic swap. He's like doing hill strides all the time.
He loves the downhill the most. And he makes this noise. So he like vibrates his voice as he runs downhill. And sometimes when I'm running downhills and races, I'm like trying to emulate that. I'm like, whoa, 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 as I'm running down.
And that's been a journey too. Like, I mean, you know, parenting, we try to make the most of it. We try to have a lot of fun, but it's also really hard at times. And there's different things like that advance in different ways. Like Megan's going to a speech therapy appointment this afternoon with him. And like, you know, it's just, you got to do different things and we're dealing with stresses in that world. So it's just kind of, the stresses have migrated slightly.
Do you know what was also an interesting reflection for me on Leo?
Yeah.
Is that, so we announced, you know, Leo at episode 100 and I don't think I was fully back to myself athletically until episode 200. So 100 episodes. And I feel like, you know, so often there are these narratives surrounding pregnancy of like, this person, you know, was pregnant, came back and won a world championship, you know, in like 6 months or like wild things like this. And I feel like 100 episodes is actually probably the more likely median of pregnancy. And, you know, there's just a lot of challenges that happen in terms of like being a postpartum runner. And I think for me, you know, I had some heart issues along the way, so it was like slightly distorted. But I do think that 100 episodes is kind of like the mean that I see in pregnant, like in postpartum athletes.
Yeah, it's so hard. And I think it points out a lot of times how the body works on longer timescales. So like Allie's documentary needed to be that long.
Because, it was 3 years long.
Yeah. And still continuing. And similarly, your postpartum documentary would probably need to be a few years long at least. And I think basically everything works like that. And it's miraculous what the body can do given that time. But in the moment, it feels like nothing changes.
Well, also in the moment, it's like all consuming and a dark forest. And I do think it's interesting when you make a montage like that. And that for Allie, what was like a femoral neck stress fracture, or for me, what would be like my heart gets consolidated into 45 seconds in this like longer 13-minute narrative.
Yeah.
And it is kind of interesting as like a reflection on looking back into the dark forest and how that shapes your life, but how often like it does change as you look back on it.
Yeah. So thank you all for listening to these episodes.
Yeah.
We love you. If you like it, go click follow wherever you listen and give it a 5-star rating. Really helps us out. And we appreciate it so much. It's just the coolest thing to be on this journey with you all.
It truly means so much. And thanks for listening to like our weird parenting reflections. Like, I feel like that very much is like the core of our life right now. I don't try to bring it into this podcast too often, but
the parenting, people actually say they love it.
Yeah.
I think, if people saw how we raised Leo, we have told this baby, I love you, about 8 trillion times. So we'll see what happens.
He still can't say it though. He's so far from saying it.
I was worried you were mad at me for mentioning that you're going to speech therapy.
Oh, I don't care. Okay. So the background is I took a medication.
Okay. This is actually, I think, helpful for people to listen to because you know, life is up and downs and you're always kind of worried about something.
Well, it's also important context. We would never take a child to speech therapy at 17 months. Like, their speech profile and repertoire at that age is not big anyways.
Okay.
So I'd probably have like
I'm clueless, so.
A wait and see approach. But I did take a medication in pregnancy that's
for your autoimmune condition.
For my heart, for yeah. Heart. That is associated with speech delay. So like 60% of kids exposed to this medication need speech therapy. So that's why we're doing speech therapy. But he very much does need it because he has heard I love you like 8,000 times, yeah. But still can't say I love or you in isolation.
But you know what he can say?
What?
Dada.
It's the only thing you can say.
For 6 months, just screams dada all the time. It's wonderful. In fact, I think that God just structured this so my self-esteem would be boosted.
Oh, yeah. I look at it. I'm like, Leo, can you say mama? And he's like, dada. Looks me straight in the eyes. He's like, dada.
But he scores off the charts in every cognitive test. So like yeah. His intelligence is really good and all there.
But maybe not speaking is the ultimate sign of that.
Oh, true.
I know, because like if I could choose as a child, I mean, I actually was mute in school because yeah. I chose not to speak. So maybe Leo is just doing that at a younger age.
And I would really think that speech is a root of anxiety in a lot of ways.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
I was reading about this recently. I don't know enough about it to have in News and Fun Things, but something like 70% of people don't have an internal monologue, or maybe it's a little lower than that, but huge numbers do not have internal background programming of just words.
Which must be wonderful and weird.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. A lot of people listening are probably like that. It's just genetic. But similarly, I imagine not having any monologue, not even having the ability to make words is great. You can't give language to your anxiety. This is great. All you can say is dada.
I know. That would be amazing. Or maybe he has a fully like lived Shakespeare in there.
That's true.
And then the sum of that is just dada. Okay, but my...
Oh, it's like a, you know, like the color white, right? Is all the colors mixed into each other?
That's dada.
Dada's all the words come together to form the big bang of dada.
Okay, my final parenting reflection is that we should have put Leo on preschool lists back on episode 100
okay.
When he was a fetus. So it is like harder to get into preschool than it is, I swear, to get into Harvard Medical School. Like we really need graphs that look at Harvard Medical School admissions and preschool admissions in Boulder, Colorado, because I feel like preschool is pretty damn competitive.
Why does he need to be in preschool?
I mean, he needs to speak.
No. School sounds stressful to me. We can be childlike with him.
Yeah. The thing I didn't know as a parent is you got to put your fetus on a preschool list. It's kind of wild.
Even pre-fetus.
Yeah.
Like the idea.
I love that. You're really believing in the pregnancy.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So parenting's been interesting. Podcast has been such a fun journey through it though. And what we wanted to do is some reflections on how we've changed, how our approaches has changed. So I think we'll look at like five things here. We're going to do them quick fire. Is that cool?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Let's do a quick fire. So very first thing that has evolved is we are now fully on board with very high carb fueling.
Well, I think we were always high carb fueling. Like we yes. were even doing that in our own training. Like I was just slurping all the time, unintentionally doing hard carb training. But now we really roll it out systematically for our athletes in a practiced and focused way.
The science just wasn't there before to say something like 90 grams or 120 grams, which is a lot of fueling. Like you really need the fuel sources. And that's the other thing that has changed is the fuel sources themselves have gotten more calorie dense and easier to slurp down. We were talking about goo and it's like goo was the industry leader before. And maybe it still is if we're talking about what people have during high school soccer.
Also goo Roctane drink mix, my favorite go-to drink mix. I just can't, the thickness and density of their gels. I actually had the reflection that I used to run ultras just like taking little sips of gels all the time. And I thought I had to do that for my GI system, but I think I was just doing that because of the density of goo gels.
Yeah. And as we talked about, science and sport, beta fuel, or precision, you can just all at once.
Well, actually the amazing thing about science and sport, beta fuel, 40 grams of carbs in a gel.
Yeah.
And so I just slurp that down really fast. And it's wild how much like how I'm not sipping anymore. I'm just truly slurping. But the 40 grams of carbs is clutch. And actually getting them at the feed, you can try all the different flavors. Great.
Yeah. So through these 200 episodes, we've seen that field totally shift. And everything that we think is being seen right now at the elite end of endurance sports is driven by this mostly with a little bit of training theory. And I think that that's really hard for people to conceive because in the past, when we've seen performance leaps like this, it's either been a fundamental change in shoes, which happened, you know, in the late 2010s, or doping or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now the reason we call it food doping is it's just as fundamental in some ways when you look at the times as the EPO era was in 1996 in cycling. And that's wild to think about the opportunity of just fueling your body, being under less stress, and getting the same benefits as the cyclist that did insane things back in 1995, 1996, when everything changed in that sport?
Well, we've had this running bit on here about the food doping t-shirt that's just pancakes with a syringe with syrup, which we're not going to do. You need much
we
more
need to do that.
Broader context for that. But do you know what it should be?
What?
Broccoli with just like two huge bags of shredded cheese going on top of that. And then like the spoons going in for the fried cheese.
Don't forget the oil.
Oh, true. Yeah.
On the doping thing, I saw a very fascinating physiological point that I think some of our listeners will find cool, is that in 1995, they had the preseason blood work of this Italian cycling team. And the average hematocrit of these people was about 38. And then once they got to the season and once EPO started being used and they started cheating, those numbers were in the upper 50s. So they were having their red blood cell count being up to 60% of their total blood count. But the crazy thing about that is that it just shows that that sport for so many years, including in the Lance years, was selecting for people that had naturally low levels of red blood cells, thus could respond to the doping. The cool thing now is this is healthy. It is legal. It is great for everybody. Literally, there are no non-responders to eating enough during training. So get it going.
Also, what I love too is that these numbers are ubiquitous. Like, it doesn't matter gender, body size, like training competitive level is 90 to 120 grams of carbs per hour is kind of considered this high carb fueling across the board.
And maybe starting at 75 to 90.
Yeah, actually, I was going to say, now when athletes tell me they're going to do 120, I'm like, ooh, let's think about this.
It does scare me.
A little bit like a volcano science experiment.
I haven't seen too many GI issues though if they're using the right fuels.
Yeah, and if they've done it and practiced it in training, I just think that going into a race and blindly doing anywhere from 100 to 120 is risking that sixth grade volcano science experiment.
Exactly. Okay, number two is we're into a little bit more strength work now.
I know. It's kind of wild how we've evolved. I feel like I've actually always been into a little bit more strength work, but you know what? I feel like we're open-minded and now we're into like big booty squatting.
But no, it's adaptive, right?
Yes,
so what I mean by that is I think that there's a problem in the strength work like
industry.
Conversation. Industry, yes. It's that it either needs to be like these hour-long hard routines or it's not counting. And essentially, we've had this swap approach always, which is consistent strength work, you know, 2 to 3 times a week that is very repeatable. So things like mountain legs, ultra legs, things that we've talked about before. What we thought about a little bit more recently is we want to add some extra juice to our peaches, which essentially just means for me, all I do is add squats. And that alone has been really productive. But more across the board, we've been receptive to the literature that has developed in strength work, seeing what athletes do a little bit in practice, do some strength, but make sure you're still not carrying around soreness, which I think is the big problem, is that sometimes these hard systems, you're just carrying around muscle damage all the time.
Also, for me too, after seeing a number of DEXA scans in athletes, like often the spine is the lowest bone mineral density content for athletes, like compared to the femur or compared to other places in the body. And it's like, load the spine, load it on the squat rack in terms of like deep squats, hex bar, deadlifts, things like that.
Load the spine.
Load the spine.
In addition to food doping. I feel like that needs to be a slogan.
Yeah, right. Well, we can make it sexier, I feel like.
Load the spine?
How would I say that? Like, bedazzle the spine, maybe? Okay.
Drop your load on the spine.
Beast mode the spine.
I totally agree. I think the bone density considerations are really important. And I think part of what's changed points out that we've gotten older, right? So, you know, in the sense of when I was younger, I didn't need to think about this stuff quite as much. And in my own personal experience, it's helped a lot with coaching. It's one reason I think most good coaches need to at least go for it at some point in their careers. And it helps to keep going for it, even when your competitive goals change, because you get these illustrations directly into how things feel. So load the fucking spine, but keep it relaxed. Don't overdo it.
Well, I love you. Really keep it relaxed. So last night we did a strength session together in our pain cave. It was very
fun.
With Leo down there. You take like 10 minutes between each squat.
No, it's not. Megan, literally, it's like a minute. What are you talking
about? Okay, it's much longer than a minute.
No.
So you do your squats. You do three sets of 15 or 12?
10.
10. Okay. Three sets of 10.
135 pounds. I'm so swole.
But I do think actually—
our lifters friends are going to laugh so hard at that.
I know. I do think actually though, like slightly higher load, lower rep is like, I think there's areas where like more endurance based reps are good. I do think for squats, like 3x10, 3x12 is kind of an ideal place to be. But you were taking like 5 minutes between sets.
No, Megan, I was going so fast. You could not go faster than I went in between reps. Okay. Next up. This is expansion of what we kind of thought before, but even more so, fewer miles in some cases can be totally okay. Parker Valley came into the mainstream and really popularized this. Ali Ostrander is doing that right now in cross country, that cross training can lead to a lot of growth. And sometimes the hardest part of running is one that training theory misses, which is that it fucking loads the body in ways that are breakdown stresses that do can actually reduce bone density over time if you're doing it in certain ways that aren't necessarily like uplifting to you.
And I think as you're doing that cross training focus, I have been in my era, and I think the biggest thing that shifted for me from episode 100 to 200 is athletes are capable of so much.
Yeah.
And I think it's not just like, we're not talking about the Parker Valleys and the Ali Ostranders who are genetically very gifted.
Yeah.
Is I give these type of workouts to athletes of all levels. And I think like, I call them my grown ass women threshold workouts in like cross training is they're big workouts. They're sexy workouts.
Grown ass women.
Grown ass women. I give them to my grown ass men too.
Yeah. Everyone gets the grown ass women workout.
Yeah, right?
Yes.
The Mary Magdalene workouts. We're on Jesus week.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. I don't even know actually.
Do you know enough about her that
I don't. That actually, that's very scary.
No, she's cool.
Yeah,
we like her. She's the original queen. Yes, Mary.
Oh my God. But I think it is important. Like, it's not like these types of big workouts, these types, like sometimes for athletes that are doing these cross training focuses, sometimes we even give double workouts. And that's not just for like elite athletes that are genetically gifted. It's for athletes of all levels. Like, you are an elite athlete and train like it.
Yeah. Like girl boss Mary Magdalene.
Yep.
That's exactly yeah. what you want to do.
She would run so fast. We'd be like, she is risen, not he is risen.
The squat rack every single time. I is risen. 10 times and then a 10 minute break. Okay. And then also in that sense, steady running and thinking about it a little bit more specifically has become a way that we adjust for athletes based on volume. I think that if athletes are lower volume in general, they need to do more of their quote easy running a little bit faster. Mm-hmm. If you're high volume, so like we talked about this weekend, shuffling and things like that is important. And thinking a little bit more about sometimes running more easy mod to mod on your easy days, as long as you have the pure recovery sometimes. Like, the skill of just kind of running naturally and kind of quickly is massive and really underrated. Like, my training build for Crown King Scarable is a great example, where I was limited in my running mileage, mm-hmm. but I was able to cross train and then got good at just doing steady runs. And that combination really set me up for race performance.
And then I think on top of that too is the additional combination of the uphill treadmill.
Like, yes.
We've been talking about that a lot recently.
Treadmill is the number one thing I think that we have leaned into as hard as you can.
But I actually need to do like a data pool and analysis of, you know, the nice thing about our training logs is that we have like, you know, we have data from long periods of time.
Yeah.
Is how often I gave them like prior to episode 100 or even like episode 50 is I really have increased the density of my uphill treadmill workouts for athletes and like athletes of all levels too. And I think it's helping a lot.
I really do too. Okay. So those are our main five. Let's do a couple like small little things. Like,
oh, I like this.
Sprinkles.
Yeah.
I don't want to have these be the headlines. But we've talked about this before in the podcast. We need to do a full deep dive into the numbers we've seen since. Is number one, post-exercise ketones in some cases has been a change that we have seen that kind of seems to have universal benefit now in a way that I never expected. And if you had told me at episode 50 or 100 that I'd be saying this, I'd have said, get the fuck out of here. I don't think that's true.
Yeah. We need a lot more long-term studies on post-exercise ketones. And
they're coming. So the labs that have done the two main studies are both doing lots of follow-ups. And apparently there's a ton of interesting data, particularly on female athletes, but it's just not out in the world yet.
Well, it's even like the chronicity of it. It's like, should I be slurping these forever? Like, you know what I mean? It's just, I kind of do have these questions. But the challenge is like, I want like 10-year studies. Like what happens in 10 years to your brain when you take these, you know, we don't know.
I mean,
but we are seeing ubiquitous results.
So. And ketone bodies are a natural thing that the body does. So why would it be super negative longer term? I mean, we don't know.
Yeah.
So tricky, but one of the interesting places that maybe at episode 400, we'll have better takeaways on.
Can I say a hot take that is very, very, very spicy, but we're like 47 minutes into this episode.
We can edit. So slow down. We can edit here. Go.
Okay. Ketones are also magical for banging. I will leave that there. No.
Wait, are you sure you want to say that?
I feel like there should be studies on these in like alternate context. Yes.
Yeah.
I do want to say that.
I think you're just healthy.
I mean, I don't know. Okay. We'll leave that there. Yeah, and if anyone has similar, I'm going to label this. This is anecdata.
Anecdata. Well, you know what? Packages are very similar.
What?
On one hand, you have the ketone IQ from HVMN. On the other hand, you have the Trojan fire and ice analysis. Sometimes you can just mix them up.
What I'm saying, my hot take is there's synergy.
There's synergy. No, and I think that
it's not the first time because the first time athletes have ketones, there's often a very strange feeling, but I think it's the subsequent times.
Yeah,
so if you have similar results, let us know.
But the point just being, there's interesting worlds out there that we're still navigating.
Are we going to leave that in there?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. That was awesome.
Why not? Did you know I was going to say that?
No idea. Man, you're a firecracker. I just let you do your own thing. Okay. And then one other thing, and this is where I might be evolving back to where I was back in the day. So like changing and then evolving is that I think that road shoes should be worn for a lot of trail races for a lot of athletes if they like their road shoe more than their trail shoe. Okay. Controversial take.
Well, here is my take is that I think by episode 300, so our next landmark, actually we'll have a little landmark song. We'll do 10 episode landmarks. I think trail shoes are going to be in a much better place to the point where they perform equally well or better than road shoes. So that's going to be my take.
Okay, so that brings up a question from a listener. Great job on the 50K to both of you. And the listener, if they were listening on Patreon, knew that I wore the Mach X road running shoe for this trail race.
Which is truly wild. So you told me you're going to wear the Mach X on Friday before racing. And I was out there racing on Saturday. And the first part of the race, like first 14 miles, really non-technical. Then it started getting like decently technical. Like there was a whole section through a creek bed.
Yeah.
Like ran up. Granted, we were running net uphill, which is sometimes a little bit easier on technical terrain. But I kept waiting. I was like, is David going to be on the side of a trail with just a broken ass ankle?
Nope. I was flying. I love these shoes. It was the best decision I've ever made. And so the question is, did the Mach X work for David? I'm thinking about using them for the Rattler 25K in Colorado Springs next month. I haven't run in Colorado yet, so I'm not sure how technical the trails are. Do you think they would be okay? I'm pretty comfortable with them on dirt roads and some rocks. They feel way faster than my trail shoes. I don't want to name their trail shoes. Although my toes don't always agree. And so big solution for me is the Mach X were awesome. I mean, even on the technical parts, and there were some technical steep downhills, I was incredibly confident in them and they seemed so much faster. And I was just like, this is something I really do want to take to future trail races. And it parallels what I used to do way back in the day when I used to just wear road shoes for every trail race, even incredibly technical ones like that they have in central Pennsylvania.
Yeah. For the first 4 years of our trail running career, I never wore a trail shoe.
Same.
Actually, the entire time, I can probably say this now, the entire time that I ran for Nike Trail Running, I wore the Pegasus for every single race.
You can say it now.
I can say it now. Well, I mean, I wear the Ultraflies now. The Ultraflies are my favorite trail running shoe.
Never wore one when sponsored, but now you're wearing them.
Episode 100 was like the era of the Speedo Evo.
Yeah.
Episode 200 is the era of the Ultrafly.
Yeah. They're good. They're heavy.
Yeah.
And which is why I chose not to wear them. They're heavier than the Mach X and I knew I needed to run fast. So that was my thinking. And meanwhile, though, they would not be good for the Rattler 25K, the specific race they're mentioning, because it's very rocky and you'll have too many steps where your foot is hitting a rock in an off camber way. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you're just risking your season for no particular gain. Like it's going to slow you down probably due to lack of confidence.
Okay. If ankles were not an issue. So like there's some people that can like jump sideways on their ankle. Yeah. And I'm like, what a fucking gift. Like that would be amazing if I could do that. But I can't. And my ankles are something I think about. If your ankles were not something that you thought about, would you race every trail race in road shoes?
I'd probably race every trail race in the Vaporfly, the actual super shoe. I mean, I think that just the tech in trail shoes is getting there, but it's not there yet.
Yeah.
And like, if essentially, what are we worried about? It's not, traction is not what slows us down. I'm sure of that at this point. Like, I have no idea why 5mm lugs exist. If something is muddy enough for a 6 or 7mm lug, you're not going to get traction with the lug anyway. Like,
which is a great point. Yeah.
Maybe a little bit helps so you're not slipping out on sand all the time. But like, other than that, just give me a fast shoe. Like, where are they at? They're coming, hopefully. Trail shoe companies, get faster.
Well, I think what I want to see, and I think I'm a little bit more tempered on this because I wear my Ultraflies on Mags this weekend.
Yeah.
So Mags.
But Ultraflies are basically road shoes.
Like, yeah, but that isn't that the point?
Yeah, but the point being trail shoes are getting there.
Yes, yeah.
But they're still heavy as hell.
Yeah, but I guess my point is that I would love to see more. There's not enough research on trail shoes. Like, show us running economy data on trail shoes. Show us how they work on different terrain. Like, let's look at mud. Let's look at rocks. Like, I want to see all these things.
Well, I have something fun to tell you.
What?
The Lab Rat Rundown Instagram, I've heard, is going to be doing running economy evaluations of trail shoes.
That's so exciting.
With the Saucony Peregrine as the control shoe.
Oh, I wonder why they chose that as control.
I think it's just kind of a normal trail shoe.
Yeah.
So trail shoe companies, get faster. But I thought of three shoe tests that I would just want to say really quickly for you to determine what works for you. The first is the jumping onto rocks test. The Mach X does not pass this. So if more than 1 mile consecutively of your race involves jumping onto rocks, you're going to want a trail shoe. Number two is the bombing downhill test. The shoe that you can run downhill fast in the second half of the race is important. And the Mach X definitely passes that test. I love running downhill in them. And then finally, the one that trail shoes fail at, the treadmill workout test. Like, would you be confident wearing this for a fast workout on the treadmill? It can be uphill. It can be like a 10%, but would you be confident? And I just have not had a trail shoe that ever passes that, including the Ultrafly. Like, it is just not at that level yet for me.
That's true. It's actually interesting because I would 10 times rather wear an Ultrafly on an uphill treadmill than a Speedgoat Evo.
Really?
Yeah, the Speedgoat Evo are chonks.
Yeah, but I guess the Ultrafly is just so heavy. That's funny.
The weight doesn't – I feel like you think about these things a lot. And like I've never once – maybe it's because actually I have foot privilege. I have a size 6 shoe. Yeah, yeah. So I've never once thought about the weight of like a shoe.
Yeah, your dainty feet help. Yeah. Okay, do you want to skip the mini science corner here?
Because yeah, we have so much news and fun things.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we'll do the mini science corner next week. But all what this talks about is how to improve your steep climbing. And if you want to get – an actual, just fully see it, go to patreon.com/swap, SWAP. There, that's where my writing is. And so I wrote an article last week that was on the theoretical basis for this. And it is so provocative that it would be the type of thing that I never put publicly fully online without the chance to defend it. But it essentially argues why running is the way to get better at hiking and steep training in general. And it goes through a very methodical argument for that.
Also, in a classic way, it's very methodical, but also hilarious. So I got the privilege of seeing you write this article at the kitchen table. And I feel like every two sentences, you would just let out this big smile. Yeah. It was both amazing and inspiring and also a little creepy at the same time.
I agree with you. But you know what the creepiest part?
What?
It's actually not that funny. I shared just...
Oh, it is funny.
No, it isn't. I shared excerpts with you, Megan. I didn't share the whole thing. It's not quite funny. I was
okay, your threshold of funny is very different than my threshold of funny.
But I was smiling not at the jokes, but at the like just amazing rationale.
Was there a
poop? At the logic.
Was there a poop joke in there?
I don't think so.
Yeah. My reflection actually on episode, this kind of relates to episode 200, is last week on the podcast, we talked about my pre-race deuce.
Yeah.
Which I don't know. I'm like very, very open, but there's something about poop, talking about poop that kind of grosses me out.
Yeah.
Like it's the humor that I don't prefer to go to, but you want, I didn't give a shit last week about it.
Yeah. We did give a shit before the race.
I mean, I gave lots of shits, actually one large shit.
Yes.
Yes. But I guess my thinking about that was just how valuable podcasting has been for us as humans.
Yeah.
Because I feel like we have core values with our podcast that are like love and kindness and science and humor and having fun.
And authenticity.
And authenticity. And those are really important to us. But I feel like our own personal image or how we're portrayed, as long as it's authentic, matters a lot less to me. And I feel like for me, as we've gone through this podcast journey, it's actually been like the most amazing therapy in a beautiful way.
Yeah. Well, the way I'm thinking about it is this week we talked about your first kid, Leo. Last week we talked about your second child, that shit. Yeah. Because that shit's actually going to preschool now. We got it on the wait list years ago.
Well, that shit can say more language than Leo.
That shit speaks in languages. It's like the movie Arrival, like the aliens that are communicating via their like painting. That is that shit. That shit needs an arrival too.
That shit is very confident in its microbiome.
That's actually a recommendation. If you've never seen the movie Arrival, one of my all-time favorites. I love it.
I love how we got here.
Yes. But no, I totally agree. Like the podcast has just made it so that you kind of learn that in bearing your soul, whatever that looks like for you on the day and just kind of showing up as you are, people love you for the things that they shouldn't in your head. Like in the things that look like a funhouse mirror to you. Like the clown staring back at you. When people see what you think is a clown, they're like, I fucking love that.
Well, actually, before we talked about the shit, I think it was the episode right before that, we talked about the fact that I had a Saturday where I spent a decent amount of time reading a book on the couch crying.
Yeah.
And after we released that podcast, I was like, should I have said that? Like, is that too much of a window into my soul? And then I was like, you know what? I didn't think about it within an hour and it passed. And a lot of people reached out that was meaningful to them. And it's just a reminder that like all of our lives are just stories that pass. Yeah. And I think sometimes when you just speak it out loud, it passes a lot easier.
And share your story. Like, you know, even if you think it makes you look worse in some way, it's like, that's the part that people actually gravitate toward. And maybe that's the biggest reflection on the podcast of all.
Yeah. I love that.
Second biggest reflection.
What?
That shit. Oh my God.
Are we still talking about it?
Megan. Oh yeah, because I'm pretty sure that Phoenix has had to shut down their wastewater management system. What are they going to do? The Final Four is in Phoenix, Megan.
It's going to be like apocryphal by the time that Leo has kids, our grandchildren will be like, did you know the story of the shit?
Well, I'm kind of worried because, you know, at the center of the universe is this super massive black hole that everything revolves around. Now we have another super massive brown hole in Phoenix, Arizona.
But we got cheese. It's countering.
Okay, perfect. Okay, let's go on to news and fun things. First thing, really fun. Adam Peter God is back, resurrected, baby.
On Easter weekend, right?
Yes.
Wow, what a timing.
So Adam Peterman did the 50K at Antelope Island. He ran really, really fast.
Ran really well.
He didn't race at all last year due to injury. So, you know, we've interviewed him before. We love him deeply. He's going to do Canyons 100K this year. Can't wait to see what he does. He seems like he is ready to freaking rock.
And I think the way that he approached his recovery, so he had a sacral stress fracture, I believe. Yes. And as I said that, I like started to panic for a second.
She was consulting with someone up and to the right. I'm not sure who's up on the wall over there, but he consulted with them.
Whenever I think or write, write words, I stare up and to the right, and it's kind of creepy.
Also, when you read words, anytime, you mouth them out as you're reading them really fast, but you just... your mouth is just kind of moves. And I'm like, that's a very strange thing to do.
I know, it is strange. I'm processing. Maybe I'm also practicing my speaking. Yes, maybe this is why Lear struggles. Okay, but anyway, so Peter God had a sacral stress fracture. The way that he came back seemed very intentional and inspiring. Like, he did a lot of rucking. So hiking with a heavy pack, probably to load bone density and to load his spine, getting back to that. And I just thought it was cool to see an athlete at his level be very intentional with recovery, or at least what it looked like to us. And I'm so excited to cheer him on at Canyons.
One of the reasons I evolved on squats was when we interviewed him, he talked about doing squats of, you know, pretty light. I mean, light in the big scheme of things, but heavy in the runner scheme of things to do that. Like, even now, 135 pounds for me feels so heavy. Like, I stand up with it, Megan, and it's like, this is the heaviest weight that anyone's ever lifted. I'm like, I should be on World's Strongest Man competition right now.
Do you think I can catch up to you?
Catch up.
Are you going to stay there, or are you going to, actually, this is a good question. Are you going to build weight?
No, I'm not looking for progressive overload.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm just looking for activation and really recruiting all the muscle fibers. Maybe that's the biggest point about strength work, is like, I think when you start applying progressive overload principles and hypertrophy interval or ideas to strength training, you're always going to be fucked, because you're never going to be, you know, you're always going to be carrying around too much muscle damage and too much inflammation to then improve in your running. So for me, it's about adapting to a level of load. And I don't necessarily want to get stronger. I want to get that load feeling more comfortable. And once I reach a comfortable place that I know supports my running, stick there.
Yeah, you want strength training for functional gains, not for the sake of hypertrophy itself.
Functional gains to incorporate into my running.
Yes.
And so actually, this is a good thing for another news and funding, a little transition, is Grayson Murphy on Instagram shared. And so Grayson Murphy, world champion last year, one of the best athletes in the world, shared this really wonderful chart. So it showed stress levels throughout the week of training stress. And every single week looked the same. It was just a pop up, pop down, pop down, up, pop down. And all the peaks were the same. Mm-hmm. So there was no progressive overload whatsoever in her stress. But there was a chart of fitness. And the fitness chart essentially looked like a linear increase.
A linear diagonal line. It was amazing.
And that's the idea of training, is that I think often people are like, I need to go keep doing things bigger and bigger and bigger over and over and over again to improve. And it's like, the body does not work that way, no matter what CrossFit has told you. Like, especially the aerobic system, but strength works the same way. It's like, same stresses over and over and over again with small variations on the type of stress makes you use less energy for the same output, which is the goal, rather than getting better at just doing a lot of hard shit.
Okay, my goal is going to be to get to 135.
You want to get to 135 squats?
I mean, I'm about to put 30s on both sides, so I'm not that far.
Megan, you're so far.
Yeah, that's not that far.
You have 50 more pounds to go.
That's okay.
That's a lot of weight.
That is a lot of weight, actually.
Compared to your body weight? That's a lot of weight.
that is fair. Do you think I can get to 135? I mean, I could if I was like focusing on a different skill set.
Yeah.
But do you think I could get there in the context of focusing on the running skill set?
Maybe if you just
I legitimately lifted 135 in college.
Yeah. Well, you just cut off my joke, but it was maybe if you dropped off one of those deuces right before, because then you're 50 pounds lighter. Just put it on the bar rack. Okay. Next up, this is a caffeine study, and we're going to use it for a little bit of an interesting transition. It just came out. It was a review study called Common Questions and Misconceptions About Caffeine Supplementation. What does the scientific evidence really show?
And this is a very, this journal article had a very interesting abstract. Yeah. So usually in abstracts, you kind of like summarize the findings of the study, you summarize the background and the intro, and it's kind of just like this paragraph that gives you a like, boom, here's a good summary statement of the article. They use their abstract just to posit 15 questions, which I've never seen before in an abstract related to caffeine.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting.
I guess the point is, if you have too much in terms of your data and findings, what do you actually put in the abstract?
Well, I feel like you put the most interesting ones, or the ones that like...
Caffeine contains multitudes.
Caffeine contains... But you could say that. But I felt like they were being like Hamilton. You know how in Hamilton, there's that line like, Hamilton wrote the other 51.
Yeah.
This abstract is the same thing. They're like, we're the other 15, as they just like launched 15 questions into the abstract.
Hopefully they didn't problematically avoid the topic of slavery like Hamilton did. Okay, so question 15 is the reason we're talking about this. And you'll see why in a second. It's, does waiting 1.5 to 2 hours after waking to consume caffeine help you avoid the afternoon crash? And I thought it was interesting in how they answered this question, which will really do our transition. There has been a trend, mostly on social media, to recommend delaying coffee ingestion in the morning by anywhere from 30 minutes to 60 minutes to as much as 90 to 120 minutes after waking. So the reason I mention that is that citing social media is kind of an interesting thing in your article. And essentially what it's doing is saying, hey, did you listen to the Andrew Huberman podcast episode on caffeine injection? Well, here's why it's wrong. And it breaks down the rationale. I read the rationale. I'm a little hit or miss on it. Like I drink caffeine right in the morning. I think you probably should right when you wake up, but I don't think it's quite as direct as they were saying.
Okay, I'm actually going to read the rationale because I think it's interesting. Okay. I think it's cool science. The primary rationales are to prevent prolonging the waking cortisol peak because adenosine levels are still declining during this time, and or to avoid an afternoon crash that some claim happens as caffeine is eliminated from the system. However, the validity and utility of these claims are questionable at best, and in some cases, not supported at all based on the available scientific evidence.
At all. I love the way you added that little flair.
I know. It's like, if you're going to say at all, better have flair. But essentially, the biological basis of like why specifically Huberman thought of this hypothesis is that cortisol peaks in the morning as the body wakes up, kind of like to prepare the body for the day. And the hypothesis is that consuming caffeine right when you wake up might prolong that peak. And then adenosine is a neurotransmitter that is involved in like sleep and relaxation. Mm-hmm. And it declines from the nighttime high. And so the theory is that like, if you're consuming caffeine right when you wake up and then adenosine is declining and then rising again.
So you're interfering with the neurotransmitter.
During the day. Yeah, you're interfering with the neurotransmitter and might like impact how your body like feels in terms of like sleep and wake levels.
Very good summary. I think that
you're like, I don't give a shit.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things that people sometimes just overthink shit. And
well, that's okay. But that my point is this is the hypothesis. Do I actually think the hypothesis is true? No,
no. And the researchers don't either.
Yes.
And,
yeah.
It's very clear that they're doing a lot of subtweets of Huberman throughout.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And it's interesting that, and if you've seen the news last week, you kind of understand why we're teeing it up this way. And that, you know, Andrew Huberman has a podcast. I've listened to it a couple times. You know, it seems fine to me.
I actually listened to it in the early days.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I stopped listening to it.
And a lot of people swear by it, you know, whatever. But it's interesting that that's become such a big way that people think about these scientific issues that a journal article is addressing a podcast. And a couple interesting things about that. One, how we, you know, determine information flow. And two, like how these hack approaches to body function might actually interact with like how your body truly works.
Or things are complex. Like
and they're complex, yeah.
Caffeine metabolism, extremely complex.
And there's probably some people that would respond really well to delayed caffeine.
Individual variation. Like we already know that the genetic metabolism of like how people process caffeine, vastly different.
Yeah.
And so it's really hard to make statements like this. But I do think that when you have protocols, it almost becomes kind of, I mean, at some point you have to put like a best guess into the universe. And so I empathize with that, but it's also like, there's just so much individual variation.
Yeah. And I've generally thought the episodes I've heard, he's been pretty good at displaying
he breaks down the fundamentals of science very well.
And the variation a little bit.
Yes.
But the reason we're mentioning this specifically today is here comes from a listener. So this is from a listener. Hot take. The new article on Andrew Huberman could have been a mini series like Serial. They really missed an opportunity here. So this article was published in New York Magazine and
it was long.
It was long, too long.
Yeah, I actually started skimming a little bit by the end.
Yeah. And so essentially it shows character issues, especially with how he treated women, essentially non-ethical non-monogamy.
Essentially, he was doing polyamory, but the women that he was dating were under the assumption that it was monogamy, which is that's an ethical issue.
Yeah. And there was more in the article, but a lot of listeners actually asked our thoughts on it. Truth is, we don't know anything other than what's in the article. I'm sure it's very complicated and we're not trying to weigh in there. But the one thought I did have from legal background is just the idea of character evidence. Because the one pushback that you read a ton online is that it doesn't matter what someone's character is. Like, I just want to know what to do with caffeine or whatever. And it's like, okay, I understand that to a certain extent. And I agree to a certain extent. But in law, character evidence is evidence on an individual's personality traits, propensities, or moral standing. And then here's the significant part. Generally, character evidence is inadmissible unless the defendant raises the issue first. So in other words, I don't necessarily think someone's character is super duper relevant all the time, unless they're using their own approach, character, style, to convince you and make you kind of like persuade you in these public settings.
So essentially what you're saying is that the way that Huberman presents his protocols, doing it through a narrative individual basis, and then we're missing that fundamental scope of who he is actually deceptive.
In my opinion,
yes,
without much information. And so I'm always really like, let's broaden it out. I don't know anything about Huberman, so I'm going to leave that behind now. We're putting that to the side.
Before we do that, can I give my opinion?
Sure.
My opinion, I think I'm still formulating, is I think that as a woman, it's very frustrating because he uses like principles of therapy and of science in intriguing ways, but I think also in ways that might feed into like some of the issues that he's had in terms of character evidence. Yeah. And I feel like it's almost like this backhanded approach with it that's actually using these things to like have relationships with six women at once to manipulate. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thank you. You just answered my question for me. Like, I feel like he's using stuff from therapy and from his protocols that should be beneficial to manipulate. And I think that is the deception that bothers me.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of gaslighting going on and things like that.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think we should leave that aside just because we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. And again, this is speculation, but yes.
It is hearsay. And like, this isn't criminal law. This is just unrelated. So, you know, if you like him, great. And we totally uplift what people like. But stepping outside that, I will say that the types of people that you associate in their character does matter. And I think sometimes people lose sight of that and they just write it off. It's like, well, this person's a brilliant coach, so I don't care if they're a bad person. Mm-hmm. It's like, no, you, whenever you're in these positions that you're influencing people, your character in a general sense does matter. It's like, if we were bad people and like they're, then it matters, right? Like, because we're presenting something differently. So I just think that we should pay a little bit more attention to general character traits and whether people like are actually who they say they are, because the downside is that like you can just manipulate on a broad scale in the modern era, because it's like this article talks about manipulating six women or whatever, but like, what about manipulating hundreds of thousands of people?
Yes.
And it, you know, the demagoguery that you'll see in politics or whatever, or historically in that field, now extends via social media to a lot of people that are reaching out there. So it's complicated and there's no right answer, but this brought up a ton of thoughts for me.
Well, I know from being in athletes training logs and having conversations with athletes that it also brought up a lot of thoughts for athletes.
Yeah.
Like, I think especially for women, if they've ever been in a relationship that has been portrayed in a different way, seeing this amongst someone that was so respected in the scientific community has actually been really jarring.
Yeah. So tough subject, and go check out the article if you're curious.
Actually, fun point. Actually, kind of a mind fuck of a point.
Yeah.
Do you know what his last podcast was on? So this dropped like right after the article came out. He interviewed like a magician and the title was How to Erase Memories.
Oh.
And I was like, topical, a little too topical.
Yeah. But also
shots fired.
I'll be curious to see where it goes just because.
Well, how do you think he handles it?
I mean,
I think there's a disconnect between how I would handle that and how he handles it, but he largely has seemed to ignore it so far.
Yeah. Well, so there's a theory of crisis management.
Yeah.
This is something I don't know anything about. You know, how he's going to handle it or individuals, but you see this often with a company like Boeing, right? When someone flies out the side of the plane.
A plane becomes a convertible very rapidly.
Yeah, exactly. Spontaneous convertibilization.
Okay. I've actually never had a fear of flying. And now that I'm a mother and now that Boeing exists in the world, if I am flying without Leo, I have like a fear of flying. It's weird.
I've always been scared when you're flying.
Yeah. But I'm not scared when we're all flying, which is a really weird, like logical next step. I'm like, we're all going to go down in the plane crash. Somehow seems better than me going down in a plane crash.
Another interesting side point. You know that they're starting to put QR codes on graves?
On graves?
In some places so that you can like scan it with your phone and then see like a video of people dancing before they passed away.
Well, wouldn't it be really funny just to like punk someone?
Yeah.
Rip your grave. That's what I want.
You want to go down together and then rickroll everybody who comes to our graves. Talk about manipulation, gaslighting everybody. But the theory of crisis management generally is that, you know, you acknowledge the issue, you overcorrect for the issue, and then go back to normal, essentially. So the overcorrection is key. But I don't necessarily think that works in this setting, because if you acknowledge and overcorrect, you're like admitting fault in such a way that has been proven to not be needed in modern society. I mean,
which is frustrating, but yes, I think that's the
what
reality.
What is Donald Trump other than someone that's decided not to ever do, nothing's a crisis, he's perfect.
Well, if Donald Trump did this, it'd actually probably elevate his falling, which is the really sad reality of the world we're living in.
Yeah. And maybe that works here. You know, like the weird part too, is a lot of these public figures get like pushed toward alt-right philosophies. Maybe there's something to it too, that it's not just like, good and bad. Maybe there's shades on both sides, that there's a little bit, I do think that there's a little bit too much of like, you know, accusatory stuff on one side and then too much on the other side of being the victim all the time. And it's like, probably it's something in the middle.
Well, that scares me a little bit, but.
Why scare you?
We can move on.
We can move on? Yeah. Okay, let's move on. Do you want to go down to Benadryl?
Do you want to do Benadryl or do you want to do glycogen storage or both?
I think we skip glycogen storage. It's a little too complicated.
Okay, we go to Benadryl.
Okay. Hour 13.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring this because I thought it was really interesting in that there's a connection between Benadryl in some studies and dementia risk. And because a lot of people take this as a sleep aid and things like that, I thought it was important to just bring out to the podcast. It's also cool science.
Well, I also thought it was interesting because I would love to expand this into athletic performance.
Yeah.
And so Benadryl is an anticholinergic, which is the properties that they think are related to some of the dementia risks. So acetylcholine essentially is a neurotransmitter that does a number of things.
Yeah.
And an anticholinergic drug blocks that neurotransmitter. But Benadryl is also an antihistamine.
Okay.
Antihistamines are often used for things like preventing allergies or like itch or things like that.
And that's how a lot of people take.
Yeah. Medication. So Benadryl is both of those, but I do think that both of these medications have implications for performance. And I think it's kind of helpful to talk about both.
Okay. Yeah. So the study that just came out that re-upped a lot of these conversations. So this science has been out there for a little bit, but there's a 2024 study that was on overactive bladder treatment and it found an increased risk of dementia with these types of medications. And I thought that was significant because there's no reason that overactive bladder should be like have tons of confounding variables that this particular medication will like that cohort will be more subject to these types of risks we're talking about.
Yeah. It is kind of wild too, to think about the fact that like Benadryl is a medication that's been used historically for many years. And yeah. We're just like starting to look into this or untangle the associations. But it was pretty strong science actually. And yeah. When you sent it to me, I was fascinated.
Yeah. So that study, and then there's studies from 2015 and things that are much broader in really big population cohorts that show similar associations. And I thought it was weird that I had never heard this association, especially considering that I've taken Benadryl a number of times and I want to be careful with all that.
It's definitely longer term consistent use. Like when you take Benadryl, you're usually taking it like once a year sort of situation. So that doesn't have broader impacts. It's more like the persistent, consistent use.
But if I don't need it, you know, like, it's relevant. It's relevant. So, you know, what are your takeaways? Do you have any thoughts on the science as it relates to athletes?
My thoughts on the science as it relates to athletes is I would be really careful with Benadryl. So
yeah.
Benadryl has a long half-life on the order of 48 hours. And I've had some athletes that have like sleep anxiety or struggle to sleep that want to take it the night before a race. And if you think about that half-life in the context of taking Benadryl at 9 p.m.,
yeah.
It's still going to be in your system when you wake up in the morning at 5 a.m. to compete at 6 a.m. And I think that's really relevant in terms of how athletes feel and also like performance implications from that.
Yeah. So you're thinking more on the performance end, and that probably is related in some ways to how these types of medications affect like the brain nervous system affect on much broader scales than just like what you might be treating with them.
No, and I think it's important to be cautious with them. So I think that's like the anticholinergic impact of Benadryl. But I think on the flip side, so Benadryl has this anticholinergic and antihistamine sort of effect, is there's been a lot of newer research looking at the impacts of antihistamines on performance. So things like Zyrtec, Claritin, like medications that are acting on this histamine pathway to like reduce allergic reactions. And there was a study that came out recently actually looking at 10K cycling performance and how having antihistamines on board vastly decreased performance.
Interesting.
Which
what
is
would
fascinating.
The rationale be there?
There's some various rationale about the fact that like histamines relax blood vessels. And so they impact like post-exercise recovery and they might impact like hemodynamics during exercise as well. So that's some of the rationale. But then there's also been studies looking at like what happens to gene expression when you're taking high levels of antihistamines and really showing that it's like blunted or altered post-exercise. This is research out of University of Oregon. And so it makes me just slightly concerned about athletes that are like popping Zyrtec all the time.
It's hard because you need it, right? Like,
well,
sometimes.
That's the question is, I think with athletes, like there's time and places where like you have an allergic reaction, like you probably need Benadryl. You might have really, really strong allergies. Like maybe like the upsides of taking Zyrtec or Claritin are better than like what researchers are still hypothesizing. Like it's not like there's like this huge body of research surrounding it. But I feel like if the symptoms are not as strong, what I tell athletes is like, maybe it's worth reevaluating that.
Seeing if there's other options.
Yeah, from like an adaptation and performance standpoint.
Okay, that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Did you know that?
No, I had no idea.
Yeah. And there's a lot more research. So University of Oregon is kind of like one of the institutions that's pioneering this research, specifically as it relates to gene expression. But there's been a lot of other studies looking at like direct performance and how that impacts things.
Yeah.
And maybe it's also just because too, whenever I take like, if I take a Claritin, I just feel loopy as shit.
Yeah.
And so maybe that also is like some of the mechanisms behind the performance changes.
It reminds me a little bit of some of the research on sleep aids.
Yeah.
Where some of them are quite poorly associated with negative mortality outcomes long-term or morbidity outcomes long-term. And people don't talk about that enough. Like not talking about melatonin here, more like the harder core sleep aids. Like it might just be worth it not to sleep as much.
Yeah.
Like
just having like low levels of sleep anxiety, probably better than popping a ton of pills. Yeah.
Yeah. Over the course of time, just given, and again, it's the population-based studies, but some pretty scary science there. Maybe we should talk about that eventually. Okay. On to other topics. I wanted to mention this really quickly. The guy that beat my ass last week, Ryan Raff at the 50K, he's going to be a superstar. But we failed to mention yet another member of the LDS church, much like Clayton Young and Connor Mance, who went 1-2 at the Olympic trials. The LDS church folks are taking over, Megan.
They're crushing it. Also, I love their training because they have rest days on Sunday.
Yes.
Unless they're racing. And I'm like, are deities okay with racing?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Yes.
No. That's like the asterisk right at the start. It's like the Bible asterisk. Just if you're racing, all bets are off. It's like, you know how that thing that like fourth commandment or whatever that we're against murder?
Yeah.
It's like when you're racing, you can kill a bitch. You can kill a bitch.
That's true. You can crush bitches when you're racing.
Yeah, you can. Crushing bitches usually against the Ten Commandments. So I love that. And I think the Sunday rest day point is actually very serious. Like, yes, there's a ton of ideas about like the LDS church is a wonderful community. It's very uplifting, very hardworking, and it can't be a coincidence that all these athletes are crushing it. On the flip side, I also think the training theory stuff of how they treat their bodies and then resting on Sundays, probably pretty beneficial. And so if it's good, if rest days are good enough for them, Clayton Young and Ryan Raff and Connor Mance, good enough for us.
Okay. My hot take too is every once in a while, it's nice to spice up your rest day. So like when you take it. So I classically, we both take rest days most often on Mondays,
yeah.
But every once in a while, it's nice to take a rest day on a Sunday. Just have like a full weekend day to chill, hang with Leo, go to the park.
This is how life changes after you have a kid. It's like, we need to spice it up. And it's like, let's change the day we have a rest day. Ooh, spicy.
Well, also my appreciation of rest days has changed.
Okay.
I like genuinely enjoy rest days. Usually not by like 6 or 7 p.m. I'm like, oh my God, give me a run. But when I wake up now with Leo and our family time, I really look forward to them.
Okay. Well.
Do you?
Nah, I've always looked forward to them. They're kind of nice.
Yeah. It's kind of different. I like it.
And I mean, if you're training well, like for me, it's always just like motivation to get there. Because I know every single time I get to a rest day, it's less about not doing anything. It's more about like, I know I'm going to adapt. It's like my adaptation day. Mm-hmm. And so if I want to keep improving, I need to work as hard at the rest day as I do at, you know, the harder work.
Sometimes for athletes too, that are a little bit more injury prone, I call them deload days.
Oh, yeah.
Like this is your insurance ticket to preventing injury.
I love that. Okay. Do you want to go straight to hot takes or do any of these other topics?
Let's go to hot takes and spend a little longer on hot takes.
Oh, a little longer.
Yeah.
I'm pretty pumped. Oh, I guess we're going to miss the one about changing jobs.
Maybe we should do that on episode 200. What do you think?
We can move on. Let's just do hot takes.
Are you sure? Let's do that on episode 200.
Okay,
I feel like it's not episode 200 without talking about changing your job or quitting your job.
Okay, perfect.
In the words, I need to, you know, this is like the compromise. I get to talk about adenosine. You get to talk about quitting your job.
Okay, on to the question. I'm hoping you'll be willing to share your perspective on being a lawyer and leaving the legal profession. I graduated from law school recently. I clerked and started what I thought was a great job. I quit that job before a year because the culture did not align with my beliefs and needs and because I didn't like being a lawyer within that system. I moved to a smaller firm and I've been here for a while. And less than shockingly, I still hate being a lawyer. Sitting in an office all day kills my soul. And although I love my clients and I find a lot of meaning helping them navigate things, I can't shake the feeling in my stomach telling me that everything about this job is wrong for me. Despite my deep knowing that being a lawyer is wrong for me personally, I cannot figure out the next step. I feel on the brink of discovering what is next, but the right answer is not emerging for me. I feel paralyzed with fear about making yet another wrong career decision. I have so much resistance to the thought of going back to school. My life feels like a problem that I cannot solve, and it is consuming me. This leads to my question for you. How did you navigate this transition within your career? Did your fear about, quote, giving up, did you fear giving up being a lawyer? What did this process look like for you? Do you have any advice for a healthy healthier way to think about lawyering?
This is such a good question, and also a very relevant question for episode 200.
Yes.
I feel like it kind of summarizes a lot of what we talk about. And so it's fun to have it here on this cornerstone episode.
And we get a lot of questions from listeners about your journey.
Yes.
Where, you know, they're like, did you go to residency? I feel like especially people that started more recently in the episode or podcast might not know even how you went through a similar approach.
Yeah.
So I think there's a few different things to think about here. The first is a general, generally addressing their idea of like, is what I'm doing right? And all that. It's like, you're never going to know that. You're always going to have doubts about the thing you're doing, almost no matter what it is. Like, there's very few people that wake up every morning and are just like, this is the thing for me. And then they just twinkle toes down the stairs for their work that day.
And that's like totally okay. And I think finding things outside of the work life, like, yeah, you know, family and sports and ultras and like slurping gels and doing fun things can be that stimulus to help you get through the workday. And if that's meaningful, that's great. But I feel like for me, this hits a little deeper. Like, it almost feels like this person's core values are in a disconnect with how they're spending their time at work. And they described it, that feeling as paralyzing. And I imagine it is, because it's like there's a friction between like, you know, how you feel on a deep core level and who you want to be. And I think like, because of this, it's almost beyond what you were just talking about. It's like, you should listen to that.
Oh, no, I definitely think they should listen. But I just want to say at the outset, I think sometimes people put this pressure on themselves to find their calling.
Yes.
And it's like, your calling is not your work. It's something deeper than that anyway. Like, you know, your work is a pebble thrown into the pond. You are the pond.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Thank you. I think it's like a Buddhist.
You're like,
take credit for that.
Buddha, comma, David Roach.
Exactly. But on that note, though, you can shine your light in everything you do. And so my first thing whenever anyone asks this is like, no matter what you're doing, shine the light as brightly as you can, even if it's not directly rewarded. Like, the prototypical example is like exclamation points in emails. It's like, do not self-censor out your enthusiasm, including in very professional settings. Like, I didn't quit right away when I was a lawyer. And that's something that's missed in this narrative, I think, is like, I didn't just be like, fuck this, I'm out. I'm this courageous beast that knows what I want to do. It's like, I lawyered for a really long time while building, you know, the coaching.
And then it took you a long time to actually leave the profession. So exactly. Like, you stayed on it, like, it was like incremental decline. Like, you stayed on it like 50%, then 25%, then 10%. And then every once in a while, they'd call you and you'd just be like, damn it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the point being that I think everyone that worked with me would say the same things about me that my athletes do. It's like, I was the same me in the sense of like presenting the type of light I want to see in the world, even when I was being a lawyer. And similarly, I think that's the place to start. It's like, wake up every day, be like, all right, I can't change this right away necessarily. I don't have to. But what I can change is feeling like I need to fit into a box made by others who are themselves miserable. So like, I think the problem is in a lot of these professions, medicine is similar. It's like, we have role models who act like it's a grind. They don't enjoy it. They're not happy and they need to be this, you know, quote unquote professional, like embody professionalism in a way that actually isn't them or productive. So shine your light unapologetically as a first step.
And then I think as a second step, this person talked about the fact of like dreading going back to school.
Yeah.
And I don't think that like, if you leave your position, like going back to school has to be the second step. Like what I tell people is like, you can kind of gradually explore and like put feelers out in different areas that are related to the background that you're in. And I think like sometimes going to school is amazing. I've done a lot of school. And
how many degrees do you have? 77?
Embarrassing. Too many. Yeah. Too many that is like financially prudent. But I feel like you don't always have to go to school. And I think like put your feelers out in different ways and see if you can creatively use your degrees in ways that like marry your passions.
Yeah. So I think the two steps right away, you know, after you identify that like, I want to be this type of person in the world and being that person starting now. The next are, you don't have to quit right away, but do start the process. Like, you start to put out feelers, like you said, contact people, do things like that, and then write down a list of 50 things you could do. Like, it doesn't even need to be remotely prestigious or anything like that. And just look at them and see what can be productive for you. And then from there, start doing something. And as soon as you find a thing that could theoretically, feasibly be a next step, whether that's school's a great option, or putting up a website or whatever, quit your job if you're financially secure. Like, that's the time to do it. But make sure you actually do think a little bit about those next steps, because sometimes I think, as much as I want people to quit their jobs and like move on to their next steps, they are mistaking the job for their general feelings about life and being an adult. And those are two different things that I you know, struggled with all the time.
That's a really helpful distinction. I also think too, that as you start to make and like percolate those next steps, I think tuning into like your emotions and how you feel during that process
is also
very instructive too, because I feel like for me, sometimes when I've made those decisions and I'm like starting to think about like, okay, I'm maybe not going to go to residency.
Yeah.
There's almost a part in my brain that is like, well, one, very excited about new opportunities, but it's also like, oh my God, medicine. Like, it's interesting to see how it solidifies emotions within my own brain.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is such a hard thing. I basically think the idea of a calling is too much of a weight. Put that aside. Like, being a lawyer is not it. But becoming a lawyer was not a mistake. Like, for me, it was the best thing I ever did because it helped illuminate the next path and the next path and the next path. And then eventually I found a path I want to stay on forever. And, you know, you don't have to be in a rush for that, and you never have to find it. Like, you can always swerve and swerve and swerve and keep on fucking swerving. Don't view this next step as the one that you have to end at. You're taking a leap, not to where you end up, but so that you can take another leap after that.
So that you can swerve and swerve and swerve and get to the point where you're talking about deuces on a podcast
yes.
and getting paid for it. What a world.
What a world. Okay, on to hot takes. We'll just do one of these. Sometimes you just have to drown out all of your thoughts with a big booty mix.
Heck yes. I love big booty mixes. Are great.
Okay. So they're actually a thing that not every listener might know about.
Oh yeah. It's a Spotify playlist thing. So it's a mashup. It's like 5 seconds of a bunch of different songs thrown together.
I can't do it.
In an art form.
It's too much.
Is it too chaotic for you?
Too chaotic. But sometimes it does hit the vibes just right.
Well, every once in a while you get 5 seconds of a song that's a total banger and you're like, yeah. And then it goes away. Maybe it's because I'm like hard to get with music.
Yeah.
It's like you get 5 seconds and you're like, bring it back. What can I do to bring this back?
It would probably be pretty good for not being able to think about anything because you're so engaged by this extremely like boom, 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 boom music. So check out Big Booty Mixes if you want to be like this listener and drowning out all of your thoughts.
Okay. Can we do one more hot take?
Okay. Yeah.
This hot take. They should make women specific treadmills.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess that means like a shorter treadmill?
I'm not entirely sure what they mean. I'm actually going to disagree with this hot take.
Okay.
I feel like I'm a proponent of a lot of women's specific things, but I do think that sometimes when you actually, Christine Yu in her book Up to Speed had an amazing like chapter and point on this, is that sometimes when you genderize specific things, it actually gets to the point where like the research and the tech that goes into both of them is reduced. And so there's very specific things like a women's bike saddle. It's like, yeah, anatomically women need a different bike saddle. Let's make women specific bike saddles and do that well. But like bike frames are an example where there's like the anatomical differences are probably vastly greater like within gender than between genders.
Okay, yeah.
And so I feel like a treadmill is another example of that.
But don't you want a pink treadmill, Megan?
I was going to say, but that's the thing is if we genderize treadmills, we're just going to shrink it and pink it and then it's going to be a lot worse.
Oh, but actually, wait, why is a treadmill not pink? I feel like why are treadmills just the same color?
That's a good point. We need fun treadmill colors. Yeah.
Treadmill companies.
Glitter.
Give us a treadmill and make it colorful. That's the big conclusion. Everyone.
Rainbow treadmills.
Independent of your gender, sexual orientation. Let's get rainbow treadmills. All right. On to listener corner. Before we do that, anything to say?
John G. I love John G. So I love John G has this dandelion yellow color.
Yeah.
And I sorted the website by the dandelion yellow color and I actually ordered it all.
Okay. Yeah. So if you want to do that, johng.com, JANJI.com. You can use code SWAP for 15% off, or you can just join their John G collective. Order there. We love this company and they are making badass clothing. We both wore it for our races. It's so good.
Really great stuff. They actually have a long bra where you can put your iPhone in the back or a phone in the back, and it is clutch for me. I love it. Love it.
And it's great for your forearm too, because you don't have to carry your phone. And when you carry your phone, it looks like it weighs 700 pounds.
It feels like it weighs 700 pounds, but I need my, this is like the thing about being a mom. I feel like I can't run without a phone, which I need to probably work on that, but yeah.
Why? If anything's ever happening to me or Leo, you're like, let's get in a plane. Let's all crash together. Yeah,
exactly. I need to be there. Okay. So we all go down.
Perfect. Okay. On to listener corner. I'm listening to a few week episodes, main podcast, and I had to pause it to message you guys when I got to David's hot take about not getting up at night to pee. I'm a pelvic floor PT, and this is 100% a thing.
Holy shit.
Holy shit.
Your hot take is a thing. How often does it happen?
As a reminder, I said that my life-changing discovery has been not to pee at night. Just being like, I am stronger than this. I can hold it. And okay, on to the question or onto the statement. I spend a lot of my time essentially potty training adults and explaining the role of environmental triggers. Being awake at night is a huge environmental trigger for people where there's this subconscious association between it and going to the bathroom, to the point where you actually feel the urge to pee even when the bladder's not full, just like when Megan gets to her peeing spot on her runs. The solution, fuck up that neural circuit by ignoring the urge and go back to sleep until you're no longer getting urges at night. Thank you for doing the Lord's work and spreading the good word.
This is such a good listener corner.
Boom, 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 boom. Episode 200, Megan. I just want to say all the ridiculous things I have said that I have thought are dumb and I shouldn't say to anybody, all of them are like this. They're all real.
This is back. But do you know what I thought about as I read this?
What?
Sign me up for adult potty training. I want this.
Yeah.
I need to turn those urges off.
When you can't sleep at night, you'll pee 27 times.
So many times. Yeah. I know. I need to adult potty train myself.
I have the rule. It has been so game changing for me. So I hydrate middle of the day, a little bit less at night, take a hot shower, and my sleep has been such higher quality. And I think it's just because I used to always wake up and then struggle to get back to sleep.
Yes.
So,
and then I would struggle back to get back to sleep. And then it was a feedback cycle. Then I would poke you and be like, I'm having a hard time sleeping.
You'd be like, can I have a massage? And then I'd be like, I want to sleep. And then you're like, no, I need a massage. And then you'll pee 27 times after that. So I'm pretty happy about this. I'm really going to take this as the ultimate urge for the next 200 episodes to be even weirder.
I love that. Same. Actually, do you know what I'm thinking though, as I'm sitting here?
What?
We should just design a bed that absorbs the pee.
Okay.
Like, we don't need to adult potty train ourselves. Yeah. We just need to design better technology so that we can satisfy all of our urges.
Okay. I actually kind of like it, Megan.
Have I said that on a podcast before?
You might have had some ideas for startups, but I think this is the official one. This is Steve Jobs unveiling the first iPod and being like, you can have 100 songs in your pocket.
Well, that's actually why you wear a black turtleneck and black pants, is that so you can sweat and pee yourself without anyone knowing.
Okay. So everyone out there, forget holding your pee. The new hotness,
black
pissing
sheets.
Yourself. Black sheets, piss yourself. We love you all.
Woohoo.
Huzzah.